Lecture 5. Brain Sources of Music's Emotional Power.
Why are we so attracted to music? We've talked about how strange the human obsession with music would seem to a visitor from another planet. Imagine this alien visitor attending a concert and noticing that the sounds coming from the stage aren't from any of the 7,000 or so languages on Earth. Even so, the audience loves what they hear and erupts with applause at the end. The alien walks out and wonders, why do the humans like these sounds so much? One of the primary reasons humans are drawn to music is its effect on the emotions. We've discussed how music expresses different emotions like joy or sadness. In this lecture, we'll focus on the other side of the coin, our own emotional responses to music. In 2001, the sociologist Tia Denora published a study of how people use music in their daily lives. She concluded that music is a powerful tool for emotion work. People use it to help them feel the way they want to feel. They use music to boost their mood or to intensify and articulate what they're feeling or to reduce undesirable feelings like stress. Of course, emotional responses to music can also take us beyond the moods of daily life and lead to heightened emotional experiences. These can involve spiritual or transcendent feelings or feelings of awe at the aesthetic power of a musical creation. In 2008, the psychologist Klaus Scherer and colleagues published a landmark study which characterized the different emotions people feel when they listen to music. They studied the way hundreds of people described their own emotional responses to music and found that most responses could be grouped into 9 broad categories. Two of these, joy and sadness, matched basic emotions expressed by music, which we discussed in the last lecture. But the other 7 didn't match up neatly to basic emotions. These were wonder, transcendence, tenderness, nostalgia, peacefulness, power, and tension. You might notice that 2 of the basic emotions we discussed in the last lecture, anger and fear, aren't on this list. And this makes sense. If people often felt angry or afraid when they listened to music, they probably wouldn't listen to much of it. The list of emotions evoked by music is largely positive, though it does have sadness and tension, perhaps because music can help people work through these feelings. The 9 broad categories I just mentioned aren't mutually exclusive, which means that one could experience combinations of emotions in response to music. In fact, if we consider pairwise combinations like tenderness and nostalgia, this adds 36 more possible emotional responses to music. If we add 3-way combinations like power, joy, and wonder, that's 84 more possible responses. We could keep going, but you get the idea. Our emotional responses to music can be very rich and varied, even if we just stick to responses collected from Western European listeners. All of this possible variability presents a challenge for researchers who want to study emotional responses to music. Now add the fact that people often differ in the emotional response they have to the same piece of music, and you can begin to appreciate why empirical research on music cognition went through a long phase of avoiding emotion as a topic for study. In cognitive science, it's much easier to study things where perceptions and responses are consistent from one person to the next. Fortunately, the tides have begun to turn in recent years, and emotion is becoming a hot topic in music cognition research. Brain imaging studies have played an important role in this sea change because they have found clever ways to deal with individual variability in emotional response. A landmark paper which found a particularly clever way to deal with this variability was published in 2001 by Ann Blood and Robert Zatorre. They focused on one particular response to music. This is the experience of chills or goosebumps or shivers down the spine that many people get when listening to music, and which is usually felt as a moment of intense pleasure. In 1991, the psychologist John Sloboda reported that chills were the most frequently reported physical response to music. He noted that individual listeners could often identify specific pieces and specific moments within those pieces that gave them the chills. People varied in which music gave them the chills, but the experience of chills seemed widespread and reproducible enough for Blood and Zatorre to decide to study its brain correlates. They asked listeners to bring in pieces of music that gave them chills and had them listen to that music while having their brain scanned using positron emission tomography, or PET. This allowed them to measure which brain regions were more active during the chills response. Blood and Zatori wanted to know if neural structures involved in generating pleasurable feelings in response to biologically meaningful stimuli like food or sex are also activated by intense musical pleasure. One of these reward structures is called the nucleus accumbens, which is in a deep region of the brain called the ventral striatum. It's part of an evolutionarily ancient reward pathway in the brain's limbic system that uses the neurotransmitter dopamine, as well as endorphins. The limbic system is the brain system that adds emotional qualities to our experiences. Blood and Zatori asked people to bring in purely instrumental music, music without words, so they could be sure people's emotional responses were due to the music alone and not to the lyrics. They also did two things that made their study particularly strong. First, they measured involuntary physiological responses, like heart rate, from participants as they listen to their chosen music. When people have chills, heart rate increases, and there are other physiological changes that reflect activity in the autonomic nervous system. By measuring these responses, the researchers could confirm that their listeners had chills, even in the unusual situation of listening to music in a brain scanner. The second great feature of this study is that researchers had people listen not only to their self-selected music, but also to the music of other participants. People almost never had chills to the music of other people, so the researchers could separate out brain responses associated with music perception in general from brain responses associated with musical chills. In other words, the fact that people differed in the music they responded to emotionally wasn't a liability for this study. It was actually a strength. Blood and Zatori found that several brain areas showed activity that correlated with the chills response. These included the ventral striatum, which contains the nucleus accumbens, and other areas known to be involved in the brain's reward system. In a later PET study that focused on the role of dopamine in musical pleasure, Zatori and colleagues confirmed that the nucleus accumbens was active during the experience of musical chills, along with other deep brain reward areas like the ventral tegmental area, which contains dopamine-producing neurons. These ancient brain reward areas are part of a system that evolved to reinforce biologically important behaviors like eating and reproducing. We know that parts of the system are targets for addictive drugs like cocaine. Yet brain imaging shows that this system can be activated by a purely abstract stimulus, instrumental music. This is thought-provoking because music doesn't have obvious survival value for us today, and it's not a chemical substance like cocaine. In their 2001 paper, Blood and Zatori suggested that evolution had somehow forged a link between newer brain circuits doing advanced cognitive processing of sound and ancient survival-related brain systems like the dopamine reward system. In 2013, Valerie Salimpour and colleagues found support for this idea in a brain imaging study that looked at musical pleasure in a new way. Instead of focusing on chills, which are fairly rare events, they studied what happens when subjects get pleasure from music more generally. Again, they found a way around the fact that people differ in the music that brings them pleasure. They had people listen to clips of novel music, and after each clip, rate how much of their own money they would be willing to pay to purchase that piece. The amount of money people said they would spend served as a measure of their musical pleasure. The fact that the study used novel instrumental pieces meant that this pleasure wasn't due to associations people might have had with a particular piece or to verbal lyrics. It was due to the musical structures they were hearing. These researchers found that the nucleus accumbens was more active for pieces that people said they wanted to purchase. But importantly, the best predictor of how much they wanted to spend was the functional connectivity or correlation in pattern of activity between the nucleus accumbens and auditory regions in the cerebral cortex where perceptual analysis of music takes place. These auditory regions in the brain's superior temporal gyrus were active whenever a listener heard music. Their level of activity didn't predict how much someone would want to spend on music. But the strength of coupling between these modern sound pattern processing regions and more ancient reward regions like the nucleus accumbens did predict how much people wanted the music. Musical pleasure seems to emerge from linking ancient reward circuits for survival behaviors to modern sound pattern processing brain circuits, even when those circuits process sound patterns with no obvious survival value. That's an interesting finding. But going back to musical chills, it still leaves some questions unanswered. Why do we have the particular response of chills to certain moments in music? And why do we find it pleasurable when chills can also accompany unpleasant emotions like fear? The cognitive musicologist David Huron has suggested a brain-based theory of the chills response in his 2006 book, Sweet Anticipation: Music and the Psychology of Expectation. His theory involves a brain structure which is known to be involved in fear responses, the amygdala. This is a deep, ancient brain structure that we touched on briefly in the last lecture. It has several subregions. It's a complex structure that's involved in interpreting the emotional content of signals. It's not just a fear center in the brain, but its role in fear is what interested Huron. In a nutshell, Huron believes that music turned an ancient fear response into a source of pleasure. His argument begins with the observation that even though people vary in the music that gives them chills, chills don't just happen at random points in a musical piece. In 1991, John Sloboda pointed out that chills were often associated with a new or unexpected harmony or a sudden change in dynamics or texture. Let's listen to an example which illustrates these phenomena from a piece by Jason Rosenberg. In the middle of this passage, you'll hear something dramatic which has some of the musical characteristics associated with chills. Huron points out that in our evolutionary past, sudden, unexpected, and dramatic auditory changes usually signal danger, so we tend to have a quick and automatic fear-based response to them. He says this is what leads to the actual chill response to music, our shivers or goosebumps. He argues that we can have that response to pieces that we know well because the response is automatic. Our conscious knowledge of how the piece goes doesn't shut down this automatic response. But why this particular response? Remember that goosebumps are due to our hair standing on end. This is a useless response for us since we're mostly hairless, but it's a useful response for animals covered in fur, like other mammals, including our ancestors. Think of a cat that's scared. Its hair stands up, which makes it seem larger, and seeming larger is a good thing to do if you're trying to discourage an attack. The automatic fear response happens very quickly. Huron suggests it's based on a neuroanatomical fast track from the auditory system to the amygdala via a deep brain structure called the thalamus. This track doesn't pass through the cerebral cortex. But if our chills are a sort of automatic triggering of an ancient fear response, why aren't we scared when music gives us the chills? Why do we experience musical chills as pleasurable? Huron's idea is that the fast automatic response of the amygdala is quickly followed by a slower response via a different neural pathway. This slow track response involves sound information going from auditory regions to the thalamus and then to the cerebral cortex where cognitive interpretation takes place before reaching the amygdala. The cerebral cortex interprets what's going on as harmless. It subconsciously realizes that what triggered the fast track response is just music, not an actual threat, so it inhibits the amygdala activity that was triggered by the fast-track response. According to Huron, the pleasure we feel at musical chills is due to a fast-track fear response involving the amygdala, quickly followed by a slow-track inhibition of the amygdala. He calls this the contrastive affect theory of musical chills. This theory builds on the dual-track theory of fear processing in the amygdala, which comes from the work of neuroscientist Joseph Ledoux, based on animal research. Huron has applied this theory to the study of emotional responses to music to come up with his own theory of musical chills, the contrastive affect theory. Is there any evidence for Huron's theory? One supporting piece of evidence comes from brain science. In the brain imaging study of chills I discussed earlier, The researchers found that chills were associated not just with increased activity in some brain regions, but also with decreased activity in others. One of the areas showing decreased activity was the amygdala. This is consistent with the idea that chills involve inhibition of the amygdala. Unfortunately, PET PET brain scanning doesn't have the time resolution to determine if there was a fast activation before the more long-lasting inhibition, as Huron's theory would predict. Hopefully, future research will allow scientists to test that prediction. For now, we can appreciate the counterintuitive nature of Huron's suggestion. An intensely pleasurable response to music might have its evolutionary roots in fear-based mechanisms in the brain. If this proves true, it will be a great example of how modern cognitive processing mechanisms tap into evolutionarily ancient brain circuits and use them to give emotional power to art. Huron's theory is also a good example of one of the recurring themes in the course, that processing music involves multiple simultaneous mechanisms. If Huron is right, then it means that even something as specific as the musical chills response isn't just the result of a single brain mechanism being activated. The response arises from the simultaneous or near simultaneous activation of at least two distinct brain mechanisms, a fast and a slow pathway between sound input to the brain and the amygdala. Now I want to turn to a more general theory of how music evokes emotion, which takes the multiple simultaneous mechanisms idea even further. This theory comes from a 2008 paper by Patrick Juslin and Daniel Vostfall, with a later update by Juslin in 2013. According to this theory, there are at least 8 distinct psychological mechanisms by which music can arouse emotion in listeners. One thing that makes this theory so interesting is that some mechanisms reflect more instinctive emotional responses to music, while others depend on individual experience and learning. In other words, the theory gives us a way to understand how nature and nurture can both contribute to the human emotional response to music. Let's work our way through these 8 mechanisms, starting with ones that are more instinctive and moving towards ones that depend more on personal experience. The first is called brainstem reflexes and refers to quick, automatic responses to salient sensory qualities of sound, like high degrees of acoustic dissonance or sudden increases in loudness or accelerations in sound rate. These reflexes are evolutionarily ancient and alert us to potentially important or dangerous events that need immediate attention. These reflexes can help explain why fast-tempo music with lots of acoustic roughness and sudden percussive events is emotionally arousing, whether we like it or not. A sound example can help illustrate this. The second mechanism is rhythmic entrainment, and refers to the way a musical rhythm can entrain a bodily rhythm, like when we tap our foot or dance to the beat of music. Humans find that moving rhythmically to music with a beat is pleasurable. We see this in young children and in adults across all cultures. As we'll see in a future lecture, this seemingly simple response reflects some very sophisticated brain processing. But for now, the key point is that rhythmic entrainment is a widespread and probably very ancient response to music with a beat. The third mechanism is emotional contagion. Earlier we talked about how music can express different basic emotions. The idea of emotional contagion is that when we perceive an emotion expressed by music, we may have physiological responses that mirror aspects of that emotion, and then start to feel the same emotion. Patrick Juslin and colleagues provided support for this idea in a study where listeners heard pop music that expressed happiness or sadness, while their zygomatic muscle activity was measured. The zygomatic is a muscle of facial expression. It draws the mouth up and to the side when you smile. When listeners heard happy music, they showed more activity in their zygomatic muscle than when they heard sad music, and also reported feeling happier. Remember how some of the cues to emotional expression in music reflect cues to emotion in the voice? Well, if you put that idea together with this idea of emotional contagion, you can begin to see why there could be some cross-cultural similarity in emotional responses to music. For example, lullabies from around the world have many characteristics you hear in calm and soothing voices: slow tempo, rhythmic repetition, and falling pitch contours. Babies from one culture will happily fall asleep to lullabies from another culture. I saw this with my own children. We played them lullabies from around the world when they were little. The words didn't mean anything to them, but they were soothed by the music, probably in part due to emotional contagion. The calm feelings expressed by the music led them to feel calm, and this helped them fall asleep. We've now discussed three instinctive mechanisms underlying emotional responses to music. Is there any evidence that these mechanisms really are instinctive? One way to test this is to see if people from very different musical cultures have similar emotional reactions to the same music. An unusual study published in 2015 by Stephen McAdams and colleagues did just this. By working with an ethnomusicologist, Natalie Fernando, McAdams and his team were able to study the emotional responses of Mbenzele pygmies to music. These pygmies live in the rainforests of the African Congo, without access to radio, television, or electricity. They're one of the few people for whom Western music is still very unfamiliar. The research team played them a variety of Western music and pygmy music while asking the pygmies to report their emotional responses. The researchers also recorded physiological measures of emotional response, like respiration rate. The whole experiment was then replicated with Canadian listeners in Montreal, again using both Western and pygmy music. The interesting finding was that the two groups differed a lot in whether they perceived a given piece of music as evoking positive or negative emotions, but there was significant agreement on how exciting or calming a piece of music was, based both on self-report and on physiological response. Using acoustic measurements, the researchers showed that these consistent responses correlated with basic acoustic features, like the musical tempo and the mean pitch of a piece. Pieces were more arousing when they had faster tempos and higher average pitch. This showed that the impact of music on emotional arousal does show cross-cultural similarity, even though the impact of music on emotional valence, positive or negative, does not. This supports the idea that emotional responses to music do rely, to some degree, on instinctive responses to sound patterns. Let's now turn to mechanisms of music and emotion that depend more on experience and learning. The first concerns a kind of learning you share with other members of your culture. This is musical expectancy. Music evokes emotion when the unfolding musical structure strongly confirms or denies an expectation the listener had about how the music would continue. The idea of a close link between expectation and emotion in music was richly explored in a classic 1956 book by the music theorist Leonard Meyer called Emotion and Meaning in Music. It's a very important idea in music cognition, which we'll discuss in some detail later in the course. For now, the main point is we have expectations because we've implicitly learned about musical patterns in our culture. That is, we learn the patterns without having to be explicitly taught, and our knowledge is in a form that we can access rapidly, even if we can't describe it verbally. Let me give you an example. If you grew up listening to Western European music, this sequence of sounds sounds quite conventional. It sets up expectations and then fulfills them in ways that you are used to. On the other hand, in this passage, there are more surprising musical events, which research shows do lead to subtle but measurable emotional responses. The responses to the musically unexpected events are often shared by members of the same musical culture because they grew up listening to broadly similar music and thus acquired similar implicit knowledge. Let's turn now to mechanisms which are increasingly more individual. One of these is evaluative conditioning, which means a piece of music can induce emotion simply because of the context in which it's been heard in the past. If the context was positive, like music that you used to enjoy with friends or family, you may have a positive emotional response, though it's not triggered by the specifics of the musical characteristics. Another individual mechanism is episodic memory, the memory of particular events in your life that get associated with particular musical pieces. For example, a song might trigger memories of when you were falling in love because you heard that song repeatedly back during that important time. Another individual mechanism underlying emotional response to music is visual imagery. For many people, music can activate mental images that aren't memories associated with the music, but images conjured up in the mind by the music. These can be landscapes or social or historical images, and these can have emotional connotations which get attached to the music. Some pieces of music, like Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain, were consciously composed with imagery in mind. In that case, a witch's Sabbath. But many pieces that are not intended as musical pictures can still generate imagery for us, which illustrates how just listening to music can be a richly multimodal experience. The final individual mechanism has to do with an aesthetic response to music. Sometimes music arouses emotion because we recognize the tremendous skill or expression that went into a performance. We can also be awed by the grandeur or elegance of the musical structure a composer has created, similar to the way an incredible piece of architecture can awe our senses. In the West, famous pieces of classical or jazz music are performed again and again. We can have a strong aesthetic response when a performance renews a piece in a brilliant new way, or when a piece captivates us because of its structural richness. Recognizing a great performance or reacting to the large-scale structure of a piece is strongly culture and individual specific. It depends on having learned what many other performances and pieces of music in your culture sound like. Stepping back, we can now see that 5 of the 8 mechanisms underlying emotional responses to music are culture-specific or individual-specific. This can help explain the great cultural and individual variability in emotional response to the same music. But that variability shouldn't stop science in its tracks. We've seen how well-designed brain imaging experiments have been able to study emotional responses to music despite individual variability in music that evokes emotions in listeners. When I described brain imaging studies of musical pleasure earlier in this lecture, I focused on just one area, the nucleus accumbens. But it's important to know that this is not the only area activated by emotional responses to music. This figure from a 2014 review paper by music neuroscientist Stefan Kolsch shows other areas that have been consistently associated with music-evoked emotions in a head-on view of the brain. We see the amygdala, which has subregions linked to both positive and negative responses to music, the insula, the hippocampal formation, the orbitofrontal cortex, the posterior parietal operculum, the anterior cingulate cortex, and auditory regions. In that same paper, Kolsch also reviewed studies in which brain damage led to a loss of emotional response to music. These are often case studies of individuals who have frontotemporal lobar degeneration and for whom music doesn't express or evoke emotions anymore. This must be a very traumatic experience. It essentially makes a person like the visitor from another planet that I mentioned at the beginning of this lecture. They can see others responding emotionally to music, but they don't respond. When Kolsch examined the set of brain regions associated with loss of emotional sensitivity to music after brain damage, he found a lot of overlap with the regions identified by brain imaging studies of music and emotion in healthy, normal people. That's important because when we see activity in a region in a brain imaging study, we don't know if that activity is causally involved in the psychological phenomenon we're studying, or if it's just correlated with activity in other regions that are causally involved. An analogy can help illustrate this difference. If I see Jane talking excitedly on the phone, is it because Jane got exciting news, or because her friend Andy got exciting news? In the case of Jane hearing about Andy's news, I'm observing no direct connection to the exciting event. If I took Jane away from her phone before she got the call from Andy, it wouldn't affect Andy's excitement about the news he got. This is why brain imaging, as great as it is always a correlational technique. The only way to know for sure if an area is causally involved in a psychological process is to see if damage to that area or transient deactivation of that area affects the psychological process. In the studies that Kolsch reviewed, patients who had lost emotional sensitivity to music had damage in many of the same regions seen in brain imaging studies of emotional responses to music, meaning that these areas did have a causal role to play in linking music and emotion. This image shows the regions where damage led to loss of emotional sensitivity to music, and the yellow circles show areas in common with brain imaging studies of emotional responses to music. Areas like the amygdala, the insula, and the orbitofrontal cortex are all critical to emotional experience in music. These images help convey the fact that when it comes to music, there is no single emotion center in the brain. Music engages multiple emotion systems. Thinking of emotional reactions to music in terms of multiple psychological mechanisms and multiple neural systems helps us address the question I raised at the beginning of this lecture. Why are we so attracted to music? Of the 8 mechanisms for evoking emotion through music that we discussed in this lecture, only one, rhythmic entrainment, is specific to music. Another, aesthetic response, is probably involved in art more generally and might also be evoked by ecologically important things like landscapes and faces. The other 6 mechanisms, such as brainstem reflexes, episodic memory, and expectancy, are all old and important systems that animals use to process real-world stimuli that affect survival. Music may be so powerful because it has found a way to co-activate so many distinct emotion systems in the brain, including many that have been deeply involved in survival. This is a prime example of how music uses multiple simultaneous mechanisms to gain its great power in human mental life. It connects abstract cognitive processing to ancient survival mechanisms, producing the intense and complex mixtures of emotions that we find so valuable in music.